Welcome to the Investment Conversation. I'm Andy D'Souza, Chief Marketing Officer here at Lord Abbett. Today, we're talking about private credit, its rapid growth, potential pockets of pressure, and what investors should be watching as the market matures. Joining me is our Head of Private Investments, Steve Koppenheimer. Steve?
Always good to be here, Andy.
Love having you. Let's go. All right, Steve, private credit, it continues to grow in the marketplace and evolve. A lot of headlines today around this asset class. It's very popular to talk about with investors. One of the headlines we're seeing, again, is some of the stress maybe on the asset class. We've talked about that last year, early this year with you as well. What are you seeing? How's that evolving overall in the marketplace?
Well, I definitely think the market sentiment has gotten a little bit ahead of what you're seeing in the portfolios. And I think it's come from a concern around software exposure in particular. And you do see some of that as a concentration in some BDCs. And I think that's drawn some attention along with not just in private credit, but kind of impact of AI generally on the markets. And so I do think that there's definitely pressures to talk about. And we can go deeper on software. I know we will later in the conversation.
Yep.
But I would add some context that I don't think is always talked about, which is we're in a bit of a heightened default environment right now. So if historically the default rate for senior secured lending in the U.S. is about 2% a year, for the last 18 months or so, the default rate's been about 5% a year. So you're already seeing a little bit of stress in leveraged finance generally, even before we start just narrowing that down to private credit. And that's to be expected, the market cycles from time to time. But you're not seeing that all coming from just software, for example. Mm. So one of the things we try to focus on as a portfolio management team is finding the stress kind of anywhere that it is. And I do think some of the market focus has been almost exclusively about software exposure, which in my opinion, maybe is a little bit overdone, even though I do think there's things to be concerned about there. And then maybe not as much focus as I would have expected on the broader market.
And software, I guess I've read a lot about that as well. Sort of go back to the why. Like why is software so prevalent in the market? I think it's somewhere around the quarter of BDCs or exposures to software. Why is that?
So I think a quarter, that'd be on the higher end for given BDC. And I do think you see significant differences between portfolios on software exposure. But where it's come from, I go back in time a bit. I think private credit in general, as we've talked about before, Andy, likes to avoid cyclical industries because we are long and illiquid. So we have to assume that there will be an economic cycle during the hold period of the loans that we make. So the more cyclical industries, things like parts of financial services or energy or parts of consumer discretionary products tend not to do well in heavy cycle downturns. So those tend to get avoided. And if we look at energy as just an example, let's say that's 16% of the leveraged finance market is the energy industry. And if you're going to avoid that in your private credit portfolio and you want it to be diversified, what are you replacing that with? Are you going heavier into some of the other industries? Are you replacing it with a different industry? And I think that some managers leaned into software, maybe that was part of the mindset. It was a combination of, we want to stay away from some of the more cyclical stuff. We believe software is less cyclical, so we're going to lean more into that. And that combined with a significant increase in capital formation around software companies in the immediate post-COVID era. And so I think that led some portfolios to get a little bit more concentrated in it than I think people are comfortable with.
And I guess timing-wise, let's talk about vintage. Does that play a role here as well?
Absolutely. I mean, vintage is an important concept in credit investing in general. Mm-hmm. And why you hear people talk about vintage is what people mean by that is, loans originated at approximately the same time or approximately the same year. And why it gets talked about is those lending conditions at a kind of confined amount of time are going to be similar. You might have low base rates or less fear in the market. And so that will lead to more aggressive lending practices in that type of environment versus you might get to another time when there's concerns about recession or rates are high, and that leads to a different discipline in the lending market. So vintage definitely plays a role, I would say, in credit investing generally of all kinds and in all different products. How it relates to software, to your question, is in that kind of year and a half, 2 years, immediately post-COVID, you had a confluence of a couple of things. You had base rates being very, very low. So that meant people were searching for yield and trying to find yield from spread rather than yield from base rates. And that usually leads to some more aggressive mindsets. You also did not have concern about recession. You're coming out of COVID, so there's a lot of optimism in the market. You also had a number of these software transactions coming to the market. And that preceded COVID a little bit, but it carried through COVID. I'd say that really started maybe in 2019, something like that. But on the back end of COVID, they had a strong resurgence. And then the final thing I'll say that came in that time period was there wasn't really concern about AI's impact on software at that time. So you saw a bit of leaning in that kind of 21, 22 vintage. One, it was probably a more aggressive vintage in general in terms of lending. And then specifically with software, there was a lot of those deals.
And with underwriting, you mentioned with the software companies, I think one of the metrics people point to there is this idea of annual recurring revenue or ARR.
Yes.
How do you guys think about software companies and using that metric and we analyze companies?
Yeah. So maybe we'll talk about just what ARR is. And before I get to that, maybe to put it in context, you know, for private credit, what are we generally doing? Like, what are we generally lending against? And these are generally called cash flow loans. And that means we're lending against two different things. One, the borrower's profitability or their ability to generate free cash flow, number one. And then number two, their enterprise value. So if we lend a company, you know, 4x leverage, and they're worth 10 times, then that's a 40% loan to value. And you're looking at that often as like how you're going to get paid back at the end. And then their ability to generate profits or free cash flow during the life of the loan is how you're going to get paid your interest as you go. And that's the typical, you know, very basic approach of what we're lending against, as compared to like hardcore asset-based lending, where you're just like looking at a given hard asset of a company and lending against that. These loans tend to be cash flow loans. So the concept of ARR really came up for software lending in particular, because you might see some very strong software companies, if I rewind the clock a number of years, that would have great customer bases, a terrific product that was growing very nicely. Maybe the company sponsored or owned by a who's who of Silicon Valley venture companies or investors. So they'd have very nice revenue, but they may not have profitability yet because they were taking that revenue and reinvesting it in customer acquisition or additional programming, things like that. And so you don't have profitability. So you start thinking, can I lend against revenue and feel comfortable there? So that's where the concept came from. As you can tell, it's a bit of an aggressive concept just in what it is, because this is a company not generating free cash flow. So in general, we are pretty skeptical about ARR lending, because it by definition means there's not profitability. Yeah. So the bar is very high for us to look at an ARR loan, and we've done virtually none of it in our portfolio. But the market, that was a common way some of these loans in the 21, 22 vintage in the software sector were executed. And it's a compelling, you know, what I just laid out in terms of a portfolio profile of a company that may borrow that way, it can be compelling. But I think what you've seen is kind of two things happen to some of those loans. One, when rates shot up at the end of 22, so now a company that, let's say a software company that was valued, let's say 25 times, when rates go up by 500 basis points, just from the discount rate, that may now only be worth in the high teens. And then you layer on that the more recent impact of concerns about AI and how disruptive that could be to software, that further erodes that enterprise value. And what that means is that loan to value keeps going up. And I think that's been, so that dynamic I think is there and we're talking about. At the same time, I do think if we talk about AI, not just for a moment, because this is where you know, we may have a little bit of a different view than at least some of the stories we read out in the market or what we hear in the market. AI in general is a tailwind. It's going to increase efficiency, increase productivity. The issue with it is that it has an uncertain impact. It's hard to know which companies are going to be the winners, which companies are going to be maybe obsolete. But I think if you look at the software industry as a whole, I certainly don't think it's all going to go away. And some of what you hear, you know, almost makes you think that that's some sentiment out there. And even though we are very underweight to software and AR, I do believe that that's a little bit overdone. I think you will have some software companies that are doing great. By the way, many of them aren't ARR borrowers. Many of them are materially profitable and have been around for a long time. And that's a very different dynamic than someone who's pre-profitability and still establishing themselves. And some of those will wind up being big winners with AI, and some of them may be made obsolete. But I think right now what the market's reacting to is it's hard to pick which one's which. So even if the market would agree, it's not going to be like a uniform negative impact on software. I think that uncertainty is what's leading to some of the concern.
Makes sense. Thank you for that. You mentioned defaults have been elevated a bit recently compared to historical numbers, around 5% or so recently. Is that, how does we talked about the concept of PIC in the past, payment behind interest. Can you talk about how is that playing out with that as well? Are you seeing more PIC, and what is that? Because in January you said PIC, elevated PIC in a portfolio can sort of predict potentially stress in the future.
Yes.
We're seeing that come true now, it feels like.
Well, I think that, you know, so PIC is a good, I like your question because it combines kind of enhanced, observed and increased defaults, and then how PIC can maybe be a precursor to that. And I do think directionally, if you're seeing stress in the market, even before a company defaults, it very well might PIC a little bit before it actually defaults. So I think that's a fair correlation to point out. In general, and we talked about a little of this before, but good to revisit, you know, PIC comes in two forms. So one is negotiated for upfront at the time of the loan. I usually call that intentional PIC, where you're underwriting the company and you know that part of their expected business plan may result in them electing to partially pay interest for a short period of time. And that can be, so think like, this could be a company that's like a roll-up strategy where you invest in one healthcare company and their business plan is to acquire other healthcare companies. And as they acquire other competitors, they may get tight on cash for a bit of time while they integrate them. And so that can be part of a regular company's business plan. Mm-hmm. You'd still, you know, prefer to see a company that can afford to do that without picking, of course. But that's the kind of intentional kind of PIC that might be part of your underwriting case of the loan.
Got it.
And then, of course, there's the other type, which is probably the more intuitive type, which is it wasn't expected. You make a loan, company's doing great, and then sometime after you make the loan, they start to struggle. And in other words, their business plan has turned out not to be as good as they hoped, and now they can't afford to pay all the interest, and that's where it comes from. So so those two types are good to keep in mind. But in general, if you see increasing PIC in a portfolio, it is probably indicative of growing stress in general. But that's kind of my view on PIC. So I do think, and then leaning, you know, combining that with your question about vintage or industry, I do think number one, it was a more common feature to allow in that 21-22 vintage. And number two, it was more commonly present in some of those software deals.
So as we're seeing some of the hiccups, maybe with some of the, you know, elevated default rates or some increase in PIC, are spreads following along yet? In other words, have spreads widened? Yeah. Again, we talked about this before where you said a lot of forces in the market in the last 9 months or so were they did believe spreads should be widening, but they weren't.
Yeah.
Are they yet?
They're starting to.
Okay.
Still early days. I would say they're modestly wider now, Andy. The last time we spoke, I think we were seeing all that spread widening pressure, but they were frustratingly tight.
Yep.
And now I think they're wider, you know, I couldn't put an exact number on it, but, you know, maybe 25 to 35 basis points wider, something like that. But before you see material spread widening, and this we are seeing more regularly, which is you get what I call better defense. So less requests for PIC, less requests for super aggressive leverage, more covenants, things of that nature. And that those type of features, that type of defense is far more prevalent in the middle market, than the large market. But you, you know, that's been, improving now.
Do you mind
for the last couple months?
Do you mind again, just for everyone, recapping, how you define the middle market?
Yeah. So everyone wants a number about like what is the EBITDA that makes it middle market or not. And I can certainly estimate that. And I'd put that, you know, just to get that out of the way, probably about $100 million of EBITDA is a good estimate to keep in mind. The reason why I call it an estimate is really the defining feature for me is, does this borrower have access to the liquid markets or not? That's really the critical point. Private credit as an asset class has shown outstanding relative performance to other credit products for decades, in my mind, for a very simple reason. That is, it's built on the premise that you're lending money to companies that don't have access to the liquid markets. And when you do that, you get more spread against less leverage, more covenants, and, you know, no surprise, through cycles, that formula outperforms. What you've seen post-COVID is really the advent of the what gets called the upper middle market or the large private market, where these are borrowers that have access to the liquid markets. And why that matters is, you're just to put a finer point on, obviously it matters that you're competing with the liquid markets, but the liquid markets price risk, depending on the year, you know, 150 to 250 basis points tighter than the private markets. So you as a private lender need to convince a borrower to, you know, pay you 150 to 250 more basis points per year for your borrowing. And that leads to a lot of pressure on those defensive points. Not only does it lead to tighter spreads in the middle market, but it leads to giving things like PIK more frequently, giving up covenants frequently, more leverage and more loose documents in general.
Got it. And you mentioned sort of the syndicated market. So the cousin of direct lending private credit is the broadly syndicated loan space,
sure.
ESLs, yeah. As they say. Those seem to be, I don't know if they're more prevalent, but they seem to be prevalent these days in some of the vehicles that are out there where people are managing private credit loans. They're also employing, and I think they always have, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. How do BSLs play a role in a private credit portfolio?
Well, specifically, I think really we're talking specifically about BDCs.
Yes.
And maybe I'll draw that distinction, because if you're looking at, you know, just a like regular drawdown fund, then you really won't see many BSLs there. And that maybe highlights the point I would make, which is, because I do think they get misunderstood a bit. They're really there because you have a little bit of a mismatch in your fundraising rhythm and your ability to deploy into private assets. So BDCs are raising money on a monthly basis, so the non-traded or private BDCs are. So they're closing on cash, you know, the first of every month, basically. Mm-hmm. Yet it could take you, you know, 6 to 12 weeks to close a given private investment. So at any given time, when you close on cash on the first of the month, you may or may not have the exact right amount of private loans available to close on for that cash. And so BSLs get into those portfolios, you know, originally intended to be a placeholder, to put that cash in while you then deploy into private loans over the coming weeks or months.
Yep.
And that's really why they're there in BDCs. I think sometimes it gets misunderstood that they're there to meet the tender features of the BDCs, which isn't really how we view that. We view really the way you're going to meet the tenders is either through the natural cash flow of the portfolios, because the portfolios tend to repay you 25 to 35% of the loan sent to mature every year, or you're going to be able to, you know, use a modest amount of your, you know, undrawn leverage to meet the tender. And those are both much better ways to do it, because usually there's a correlation between investors wanting to take more advantage of the tender and there being pricing pressure on liquid loans. So you don't really want to be selling a risky asset to meet liquidity. And that's why I draw that distinction.
One more part here. It might be a little too in the weeds, but a curious question. On the BDCs, mechanically speaking, what does the BSLs do for a portfolio, or what's the challenge there?
Yeah, so why investors prefer not to see a lot of them, maybe I'll enter that way, is they tend to add volatility and decrease yield because they are more volatile from a price perspective and their spreads are tighter. And they're also just kind of easier to get. So investors that are looking for exposure to private credit from a given manager, they're usually looking for like the origination of that manager into their version of private assets and their kind of specific advantages. And so it's viewed a little bit as kind of mandate drift if there's too much of it. I think investors understand that there'll be some BSLs. It's a matter of degree.
Got it. Well, we talked about industry concerns on software today. We talked about vintages. We talked about PIC, use of BSLs and the BDC portfolios at large, underwriting standards, spreads, a lot here today. I guess it seems like there's a lot of maybe some noise out there right now. Why would someone invest in private credit today? Why would it be a good time in your mind?
Well, so we like markets like this. And maybe I'll start with comparing it to where the market was a year and a half ago, where there was really no concern. And when the markets are like that in any asset class for an extended period of time, you start to see, one, that asset class start to get priced cheaper as if it is less risky. And you start to see less discipline on some of these defensive things like covenants or PIC. And so having a little bit of chop in the market, you know, just reminds everyone this is a risky asset class. And that's good as an investor because all the things you asked me about earlier. So we're starting to see spread widening. We're starting to see improving fundamentals of loan covenants and documentation. That's a more attractive environment for us to invest in, where we can continue to outperform. And for us, we've got, you know, material amount of our capital is dry powder. So we're able to look very selectively in a market like this. And I'd add to that, you know, when you see a little bit of a pullback, that also means there's less capital chasing that strategy as well. So a little bit less competition, wider spreads, better documents. So we actually like markets like this.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Steve, thanks for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Andy.
All right. Thank you for listening to The Investment Conversation. Find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts or at lordabbott.com. And follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and YouTube for more perspectives from across the firm.
This podcast is intended solely for informational purposes and is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation. The contents are based on available information at creation and subject to change. It is not intended as investment, legal, or tax advice. Lord Abbott is not acting as your fiduciary. Past performance is not a reliable indicator or guarantee of future results. All investments involve risk, including the loss of capital. Certain information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources, and such information has not been independently verified by Lord Abbott. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. References to specific asset classes and financial markets are for illustrative purposes only. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information in this podcast does not constitute an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. For additional information on risk and a glossary of terms used in this broadcast, visit lordabbott.com. This broadcast is the copyright 2026 of Lord Abbott & Co. LLC. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 19, 2026.